Session number 23848, reel 26.
Mr. Wildgust, reel 26. Did you have any problems readjusting back to civilian life?
Well, there were some. We were fortunate enough to manage to get a house to rent, which was fortunate. My father knew an estate agent, and he told me we could have a house to rent. It was in one of the poorest parts of Nottingham, which I would never have gone visited under normal circumstances. It was a terraced house.
What part was that?
Down in what's known as Stenton Dale, but Stenton itself was always looked upon as a terrible place to live. But Stenton Dale was a little bit more middle classy. They were long terraced with entries and yards at the back, and built in, well, late Victorian, early Edwardian times, 19th near the century type. And we moved into this place with no furniture whatsoever, apart from a three-quarter iron bedstead that my mother let us have, because she hadn't got any spare furniture. I think we had a chair with the back off, and a cot, because our baby had been born then. And that was it. A neighbour gave us some bits of curtain. We had a piece of felt on the floor. But then we applied for dockets for furniture and for floor covering and sheets and blankets, which duly came. And we wrote to a friend of my wife's, whose husband had been killed in Burma, and suggested that she told the authorities she was coming to Nottingham to live with us, and could she have her dockets, which she duly did, and sent to us. So we did get a few extras. I remember going for an advert for a three-piece suite, which when I saw it, they wanted £99 for, which was in those days was sort of 6 months' income. And we eventually bought the first utility furniture, which comprised of a bed settee and two supposedly easy chairs. You could either have them in rust or green. We wanted them in rust, and they sent green, and there was virtually no padding on them. And no sooner had we had them than the second lot of utility furniture was issued. And for the first time, I sold something at a profit. I managed to sell this bed settee, which had wooden arms. They were utility. My God, they were. And in the dining room, we managed to get hold of a table, an old kitchen table for £2. We had no heating, apart from a coal fire with an oven and a grate. It was with a hot water compartment at the side of the fire, which heated the water. There was no hot water system. There was one cold tap, a copper, which we never used. And because we had moved into an area which we didn't know, of course, any of the tradesmen. So we couldn't sort of engineer any extras. Everything was still rationed and on dockets. And the coal was rationed. But that first winter, the winter of 47, was so cold that I used to bring a lump of coal from the barracks at Derby when I came home, and we used to light a fire in the evening. And that was all we did have. We couldn't get potatoes. We wrote to my wife's mother to see if she could send us any by post, because we didn't know the local greengrocer enough to be able to get any, because they were keeping them for their regular customers. And I remember in Derby seeing potatoes at 10 shillings a pound, which I don't know what would translate at now, but they were far too expensive to buy. And this terribly cold winter, it was we had ice inside the house, up the walls. We managed to hire a gas stove, which was made in about 1930, through my sister, who knew somebody at the gas board. And we had an old yellow sink, and no bathroom, no toilet. Well, I had a toilet outside. And I know that our baby, I don't think he was out of his cot for about 3 weeks. It really was terrible. And in the meantime, of course, I was going backwards and forwards to the army in Derby. So when I came out of the army, the frost went on until the beginning of April. It had been solid from January, February, March, and by the time April came, it began to thaw, and we had a relatively pleasant spring. But I always remember it because, of course, everything was held back with the frost, and when spring came, everything came out at once. We had sort of almond blossom and blackthorn and may blossom all at the same time, and it was a very spectacular spring, and the weather was quite decent. But in a way, that was a relief when I came out of the army. But you were so concerned, really, in just living. I remember the first pay I got was about £20 a month, and because after stoppages and pensions, all that sort of thing. The £20 a month, the first month I remember I had a pound over, and I bought a spade with it. But it was generally, if you had a pound or £2 left after you paid out what you owed, that was as much as you did have. We were fortunate in one respect that our local grocer, who was in the middle of Nottingham, one of the assistants, was particularly helpful and used to pass us bits of ration stuff which was superfluous to rations. Particularly tea. We had more tea then than I think we've ever had in our lives. And he'd probably slided a bit of butter extra. But I remember that on average the weekly grocery bill was probably about 17 and sixpence, or which what converted 75 pence or 15. But even so, after about 3 months I got into debt to the tune of £10. And I had a letter from the manager of the shop saying that I'd have to pay off 10 shillings a week plus what I was buying at the time. So from fairly affluent life, we suddenly found ourselves very, very much in hock. It reached a stage once where my wife had to pawn some of our wedding presents because some friends were coming for tea. But,
how did you feel... this was like the peace that everybody had been looking forward to for 6-7 years.
Well, I always say now that the years after the war, from 1947 to 1953, were worse than the war years. They really were terrible. The only thing in our favour was that everybody was in the same boat, so nobody was envious of anybody else's possessions. If they did do a little bit better, good luck to them. What did, for a time, annoy us, not only me, but friends of mine who'd served, was the ones who hadn't served, the reserved occupations, during the war made themselves very nice jobs and made themselves very comfortable. And I remember one lady whose name I will not mention at the time, who was a friend, said to three of us, what are you going to do now? Be butchers, implying that her husband hadn't been called up. But we thought that was rather bad form, that she'd take that attitude to people who'd, you know, given up all their freedom. But it was very hard. It really was. It was there didn't seem to be much future. Nobody ever thought of having a car. I mean, that was the last thing that you'd ever have in your life would be a car. And certainly to get a house was almost impossible. I mean, whereas I had a house to live in, at least we were by ourselves and we were able to improve on it. My friends lived in rooms, many did. Admittedly, some of them didn't get married until a year or two after the war, and they lived with their parents. But the ones that were married were just having to make do with what they could get. I mean, I remember pre-war in Nottingham, there were rows and rows of Victorian houses which were empty. But of course, by the end of the war, they were all filled, and what were once big Victorian houses had become flats. and very desirable properties. But the thought of, or the prospect of buying a house was almost impossible. There again, I was naive about these things. I mean, I didn't know how to buy a house. I mean, I didn't know. You had to have a deposit. You couldn't just go in and get a 100% mortgage. You had to probably find 50 or 25% of the price before you could even consider it.
Now, earlier in 1945, there'd been the election.
Mm-hmm.
And you've talked earlier about your father and your father's left-wing sympathies. What expectations did you have for the 45 election, and were these expectations fulfilled?
I didn't really take much notice of it as an election. I didn't anticipate that any government would be any different than the one we'd had, or the conditions would... I didn't vote with hoping for a grave new world. I remember we gave out voting slips to the soldiers, and we used to ask them in conversation, who are you voting for? And they say, I'm voting for my father, or I'm voting for my mother. And for most of us, that's all we knew about politics, because of course we'd had a national government prior to the war, and then during the war it was a national government. And or to be suddenly confronted with Liberal and Labour and Conservative didn't mean much to most of them, or to me for that matter. But as I say, most of the soldiers, who were also had never voted before, just sort of took the view, well, whatever my dad voted for, I'll vote for as well. There was, of course, obviously history has proved that, there were people who'd been unemployed before the war and had hard times before the war, and probably the war had helped them to some extent, and decided that they weren't going to go back to what they'd had before. And when the result came out, the general feeling was that, to a large extent, Churchill had been let down, and that we didn't think really much of, well, about the government. We weren't particularly enamoured with the leaders we were stuck with. But,
so was it a shock when Churchill was defeated, personally?
Yes, it was quite a shock, I suppose. But of course, again, in retrospect, it was probably the best thing that ever happened. Because I think if he had got back into power, I don't think things would have changed at all.
Now, you mentioned your father earlier in the interview. What was his kind of politics at this stage?
Oh, they were
46, 47.
They were pretty red at the time, but and of course he was pleased that the Labour Party got in. But there again, I remember when I came back, I was in the electricity department, and in those days everything was done by hand. All the rentals, as I recall, were written in longhand, and all the amounts were put in with pen and ink. And you sent out your accounts every quarter, and after you sent the accounts out, you sent them a 14-day reminder. And another week later, you sent them out a 7-day reminder. And anybody who hadn't paid then, you sent them out a 3-day reminder. And you not only sent those out, but you put in the gas, water, and electricity and rates in one envelope, if possible, so that you saved postage, which is a good system, which they don't even do now. But I had one account in a very salubrious area of Nottingham, Mopley Park, by the name of Payne. And he was the managing director of Payne name tapes. They took over the business of cashiers of Coventry. Remember, the cashiers made name tapes and were bombed during the war. And Payne's were doing the same thing in Nottingham, and he'd made a small fortune. And when his electricity bill reading came in, it was so big we queried it. And we sent an inspector round. And every light in the house was on. And neighbours told him that it was on day and night, every light, hall, bedrooms, everything. And they were abroad. And when they did get access to the house, we found that the meter had gone round twice, So not only had he got a big bill, but they got about treble the bill that was the original. And when confronted by it, they said, well, we're trying to get the government out. By using electricity, we'll make power cuts. So this was the sort of attitude at the time. If we can sabotage the Labour government, that's what the Conservatives or what people of our stature should do, you see. which quite amused us, really, because we thought if anybody's got that amount of money they're going to spend just trying to cause blackouts and the rest of it. Because, of course, that was a feature of the time. I mean, electricity would go off for a few hours and then the gas would be cut off and coal was at a premium, that was rationed, and then when bread was rationed, that was the end, really.
And when did that come in? When did the bread rationing come in?
Shortly after, it was after the bad winter 47.
So that was time. Well after the war?
Yes, after bread. The war, yeah. It wasn't rationed for long, but of course the rationing went on until 1953.
Now, you've talked about when you were involved in the personnel selection and so on, the later stage of your army career, where things seem to be, from how you've described it, very, very rigorously structured, and you know, quite a detailed approach to work, if you can call life in the army work. How did civilian employment compare? Was it easy to readjust back to civilian employment, and what were the differences?
No, funnily enough, the jobs, they say there were jobs for everybody, but there weren't jobs at all. In the war production, that was dropping off all the time. But of course, we hadn't been educated, at least I hadn't been educated, to that sort of a life. It was still the clerical sort of jobs. And you didn't even know how to apply correctly by letter. I mean, I remember applying for some office, a firm called Kalamazoo, an American company, and I got nothing out of that. There were some jobs in insurance, and there were some jobs in the banks, I believe, but nobody sort of offered. There was nobody to offer you jobs or find you jobs. You were left very much on your own. I did apply for a grant for something or other, and they wrote me a letter saying that they were prepared to pay my fees for the exams that I should take with the City Treasurer's Department. A correspondence thing, which I decided to take. But when I got the first paper, I couldn't do it, but the second paper was quite beyond my comprehension, and I thought, this is ridiculous. I don't really want to do it, so I packed that in. And I applied for a job as a school attendance officer. My father knew the member of that particular committee who was uneducated. He had been Minister of Education in Nottingham, not Minister of Education, but on the Education Committee in Nottingham, and he was the most uneducated man you could possibly wish to meet. He came to our school speech day before the war and said that he hadn't had a decent education, and I'm pleased to be here, sort of attitude. And when I went for this job, somebody whispered in his ear, but he's working for the City Treasurer. He said, well, in that case, you can keep the job you've got. You'll be far better where you are. And yet I would have preferred the job that was offered. They didn't. I don't know whether they were frightened of their own jobs then, because, of course, a lot of people had gone up through, well, they'd made progress because of the absence of other people. I mean, I remember a school friend of mine, he hadn't been called up for medical reasons, and he was a manager of a bank, or became the manager of a bank, but when the war ended, they gave the job back to whoever had had it before and fired him. So they weren't exactly sympathetic to anybody. And the main problem with all of us, without exception, was the fact that we just didn't know what the job market offered. Quite a few of my school friends went into the teaching profession. Funny enough, it was all the boys who weren't very bright at school. They were all had reasonable education, but they weren't the top-notch people. They made very good teachers, it so happens, lots of them, but when I applied, as I thought of applying, the scheme ended, and that was probably a job that I would have done better than any other job had.
And there was nothing within the very last period of your time in the army that prepared you for that? There was no courses, orientation for civilian life or anything like that?
No. You were very much left on your own. I mean, they didn't help you at all.
So, did you stay with the City Treasurer's Department through?
I stayed with them. After about every year, we had to post in the electricity and these departments. They used to take deposits from business accounts as a guarantee against unpaid bills. I mean, it would probably only be £10 or £5, but they'd have that as a deposit in case they defaulted. I mean, they even took £10 from Lever Brothers. But and every year, although they took the deposit, they would pay them interest. So every year, they had to post the interest on their deposits to their accounts, which usually was threepence or sixpence, something like that. And I got hold of what they call posting strips, and I noticed that the top date was about 1928, and I was filling in 1947, and the bottom one would have gone to about 2005, and I thought, my God, I'm going to see my whole life on this posting strip every year. I decided to leave. I hadn't any real knowledge of what I would want to do or what I could do, and I saw an advert in the paper for a firm of Libby's, come for American firm, Libby McNeil and Libby, and a friend of my father was the manager at the time, or the area manager at the time, and he wanted a rep. I knew nothing about it. And I went to him and asked him for a job, and he said, well, I don't think you want it. He said, we're paying only £5 a week, he said, we're paying. There's no car, you'll have to do everything on. And I said, well, I'd rather try that than do what I'm doing now. So I went to them, and again, I hadn't any idea of what you're supposed to earn. So for 2 years, I earned less than I'd been earning before. But I got a few expenses, and I got samples, and I got food. Got food parcels from America as part of the perks, which were quite useful.
Who were they sent by?
Libby McNeil and Libby. Remember, you don't know Libby's fruit. You only see them occasionally now, because they were taken over by Del Monte. But they were a very big firm that sold corned beef and canned fruit, peaches, and apricots.
And they would send food parcels to their employees. Yeah. Because they knew the conditions in Britain. Yeah. What would be in the food parcels?
Oh, they sent, I've got a note of it somewhere. In one of my wife's diaries, they send rice, sultanas, tinned salmon, because Libby's used to canned salmon, canned ham. There'd probably be 8 or 10 different items, and all with the Libby brand.
And how often would you get the food parcel from
about every 2 months, as far as I remember. They were fairly regular, and the reason that they were doing business was in England, or keeping the rep on, was that, of course, canned fruit, canned fish was still rationed and allocated. And these firms acted as distributing centres for the Ministry of Food. They didn't get their own canning stuff in. They got in what was imported into the country, and then it was sent around and distributed. And Libby's, to keep their name on the market, were having baby food manufactured by Nestle and having the cans with their own label on. It was purely to keep their name in front of the public in some way or other. So I was selling baby food. Nobody wanted it, mind you, but very little. Because it was a new concept. I mean, Heinz were in on the game, and Libby's. And I travelled the sort of East Midland, or Nottinghamshire, Leicestershire, Northampton, Derbyshire, I think. I can't remember now. And I had to do it on a bus or on the train. They used to pay very good expenses. You were allowed 5 shillings a night for bed and breakfast. 4 and 6, something like that. And so they pay your train fares and your bus fares, and they give you about 4 shillings for a meal during the day. And I used to allocate myself 6 pence a day for a meal at lunchtime, which usually consisted of a cup of tea and a roll of butter at Lyons or Woolworths or somewhere. And it was getting a bit desperate, and eventually I saw an advert for a wholesale grocer's firm in Nottingham, applied for that, and the man I was interviewed by happened to have been in the First Army in Tunisia, and said, well, do you want the job? And he said, how much do you need? And I said, well, I'll have to have about £7.10. About 2 months later, the boss said, why don't you put in for a rise? Because they couldn't understand how anybody could have asked for so low a wage and not expect to get more. That's how dim I was. And that job was much better, because I was local. And with food being rationed, I had the opportunity to one way or another get every type of food imaginable. I mean, we could get biscuits and canned fish and canned fruit and tea and butter and chocolate biscuits.
Were you tempted to sell any of this?
No, only for my own use. I mean, I had, for instance, I mean, to give you an idea what sort of thing that went on, there was a community centre near where I lived. Good, by this time we'd moved from our original house and did a swap with a council house in a much better house. And this community centre had dockets for canned fish and fruit and tea and sugar and all the rest of it. And when we got an allocation as a rep, you were given so much and you shared it amongst your customers. On an even, equal basis, if you could, but they always used to give you more than your allocation, so there was always spare. And that spare always used to go to a friend of mine who happened to be running something like that, and then we just share. We never made money on it, the product was more use than the money in those days. So we never went hungry, and the job was quite reasonable until I saw an advert again in the paper for a biscuit company, McDonald's of Glasgow, that make chocolate penguin. And in those days, Munchmallows and Yo-Yo and Glengarry biscuits. And I wasn't able to keep the appointment. And I rang the hotel and said that I couldn't make it. Could I come tomorrow? And the chappie said, yes, come tomorrow. And I met him in the foyer, and on the way up in the lift, he said, would you like the job? He said, I've interviewed all day yesterday, and he said, I've never met such a lot of people. He said, I reckon you'll do. And they said it, we must make it worth your while. He said, we'll give you 15 shillings more than you're earning now, but we don't provide a car, but we'll pay you £10 a week to buy your own. And I remember when I went home, and I told my wife, she didn't believe it. Neither did I, actually. And I worked for McDonald's for 5 or 6 years, and it was the only thing that ever stands out now about that particular firm was that I did business with Margaret Thatcher's father,